The state's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education released guidance today on how schools could reopen this fall, and it includes a lot of things you might expect: having teachers and students wear face masks, spacing desks at least 3 feet apart, and keeping students in the same group throughout the school day. But there are still some unanswered questions. And joining us now to help answer some of those questions is Jeff Riley. He's the commissioner of the Education Department. Commissioner Riley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start by acknowledging you had a pretty tough balancing act here. You're trying to weigh public health and safety concerns with concerns about students' academic and emotional well-being. So I'm curious, as you were forming this plan, what are some of the most important factors you were thinking about?
For us, the key, I think, was the safety of our students and teachers as we sought to go back. And we kind of researched and really enlisted the best medical people we could find to help us think through what are the best actions we can take to make school safe when we do return.
So, speaking of medical experts, I know you got a letter from the Massachusetts chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, really encouraging students to go back to in-classroom learning in the fall. They're especially concerned with children who rely on additional services schools supply, like counseling services or food supplements, things like that. And they're also concerned that remote learning kind of exacerbates the achievement disparities across income levels, racial groups. What did you make of that letter, and did you have a response to some of those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were grateful for the endorsement from the incoming president of the Pediatric Association in Massachusetts. He believes, and their association believes, that kids should go back to school. There are costs associated with kids being out of school, and we've seen some of those. We understand there's food insecurity, there's trauma and mental health issues. There's all the racial issues that have come up that school would be a good place for teachers to kind of work on helping students process that information. So there's certainly a lot of reasons to go back to school. And at the same time, we recognize that we want to do so in a way that's, as safe as completely possible.
So there are concerns that just being closed for the few months that schools were closed this past term, that basically some students could be up to a year behind in terms of where they would be education-wise, a study that was published by the New York Times. Do you have any specific approaches to catching those students up that might have fallen behind during the period of closure?
Yes, we do. I mean, what I would say is, first and foremost, I don't think anyone believes that any type of remote learning can ever replace what happens in-person instruction. We just don't think it's comparable. With that said, we're not exactly sure what the gaps will be. We do think that there will be learning loss, and we do need to kind of sort that out and assess that in our students. There have been some who have said that we need to go to assessment in the first week of school, and I've said no. I think we need to get our kids back into the routine of learning and focus on their social emotional health in the beginning. But there will be a time, and districts always do this in the first month, where they kind of assess where students are functioning. And at that point, we'll really have a better idea of what the learning loss is and where it is. And then when we talk about how do you remediate that, we've put out a multi-million dollar grant program for districts that are interested, both in the summer and over the vacations, to work with students who have fallen behind.
So you talk about concerns bringing kids back to the classroom. Mass Inc. Polling Group recently did a poll kind of looking at different groups of parents and how they are thinking about returning to school in the fall. And there were some pretty staggering numbers in terms of Black and Latino parents of K through 12 students. Basically, 69% of white parents either felt very or somewhat confident in sending their kids back to school, but just 48% of Black parents, 44% of Latino parents feel the same way. I'm struck by the fact that those are the same racial groups that have been hit disproportionately by the pandemic. What would you say to some of those parents who are feeling those concerns right now?
Well, I mean, look, I want to be clear. Our parents, we respect their decisions and their choices on their children and schooling. And so we understand there are concerns, and we're going to be sympathetic to those and work with parents as schools open on what they choose to do. I do think that we have seen variation across the state in communities that have been hit hard and some others that haven't. And so the question for me is, how do we provide additional supports to those districts that have been hit the hardest and or those districts that have been historically shortchanged to make sure that they get the resources that they need, both technical, financial, computer devices and such, so that we can get out, so we can make it as fair as possible. And at the same time, you know, today I think was the first day we saw the medical community stand up and say, we do think going back to school is the way to go. And so, you know, we're going to let parents make their decisions on what they think is best for their children. What we're going to try to do is make sure that there's a sense of equity and fairness across our communities.
You mentioned financial as one of the concerns. Obviously, anytime you're talking about schools, they're often asked to do a lot on a shoestring budget. We actually spoke with Joseph Sawyer, superintendent of Shrewsbury Public Schools, and he said he's confident in the research that the state has done and consulting with public health experts, but basically the challenge is figuring out how to afford everything on this pretty condensed timeline. Here's a little bit of what he said.
If you've had a lot of experience with it, if you've seen your family members or your neighbors go through the symptoms.
That's actually Steve Pizzella of Massing Polling Group looking for Joseph Sawyer, Edu 4, if we could get Edu 4 from the control room. Challenges of remote broadcasts. So bear with us.
It's both trying to plan for doing school in a way that we've never done before, at the same time with huge question marks about the amount of funding that we'll have, not knowing the level of staffing we'll have to be able to execute the kind of planning and work that will need to happen to come back to school in the fall is probably the most complex work that school administrators have done in their career.
So I understand, Commissioner, that you wanted to leave things open so that districts would have flexibility to do what they feel is right for their district. But in terms of funding, what can you tell schools who are looking at, hey, the state has a potentially $4 billion shortfall in the budget? We know that Gateway Communities, for example, we're going to get an extra $217 million this year alone. What would you say to schools who are worried that the funding to establish these new protocols just isn't going to be there?
Well, it's certainly something that we have to kind of pressure test. What I would say is what we know is this. The Department of Education applied for and received federal money, almost $200 million that we sent out to districts. Are they eligible to apply for those dollars? And it's based on a Title I formula. So essentially, the poorer communities get more money. Today, in addition to that, the governor announced an additional $200 million for districts to get even more money, because I think there is a recognition that to bring schools back under the new medical kind of conditions or parameters will cost money. Now, the hard part and what we don't know right now is, will there be a fourth stimulus package from the federal government, and what will the funding look like in Massachusetts? And because we don't know, and because we probably won't know until July or August even, and maybe even beyond that, what we've done at the department is we've said, be prepared for all contingencies. Be prepared for remote learning, be prepared for a hybrid model, and be prepared for an in-person model with these medical parameters. But what I think is, and as an advocate for the educational community, we need to kind of really stand tall and say that there are funds that are going to be needed to do this safely and to do it well.
Yeah, I think I know some activists in the state have asked if you're willing to dip into the about $3.5 billion rainy day fund. Is that something the state's thinking about if the federal government doesn't come through, say?
So, I don't want to speak for the administration. I'm the Department of Education, but I think they'll look at everything given the financial situation. And I think a lot of people now are waiting to see what the federal government is going to do with this fourth stimulus package or not. So I think that will be kind of a tipping point. Until then, the best we can do is, we've been able to get additional dollars for the schools, and we can plan for a variety of contingencies so that we can get the best possible outcome.
So I want to come back to something you said about preparing for basically all contingencies. I understand we don't know what things are going to look like in the fall, but from a teacher's perspective, that obviously presents a pretty big challenge. I want to play a little bit of sound here from Joellen Persaud, an inclusion and moderate disabilities physics teacher at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, talking about kind of what that means for teachers on the ground.
That is so much work to now have to plan for online learning as well as in-person learning. The idea that these two things, like, oh, just record your lessons, oh, just that is indicative that you are not a teacher. That's not what you really need to do to engage students online.
So I'm actually a former high school teacher myself, and I totally can understand where Joellen is coming from there. You would present a lesson plan totally differently if you're connecting remotely versus if you're in the classroom. So what do you make of the fact that you're asking teachers to basically prepare two lesson plans as they approach the fall?
So I don't think that's exactly what's happening. What we're looking to do right now is to say, we don't have control over the trajectory of the virus. We're not exactly sure if we're going to have a second spike or not in the fall. And so at the end of the day, we have to be ready for all contingencies. Now, what I think the teacher is speaking to, and as a former employee at Madison Park, what I would say is, you know, we have to be smart about how we figure this out. And in-person learning is obviously probably the most desirable possibility. But if you do hybrid learning, what we need to do is minimize the extra effort put on teachers by doing that. Now, you could do that in several ways. You could use teachers that have underlying medical conditions or are over a certain age who may not be able to come back into the classroom and put them on kind of the online portion of that. We are in the process of looking at a learning management platform, which is a computer-based program, which is more student self-directed. And so there's just different opportunities to look at it. Now, the live streaming option is also a possibility, right? If you're teaching a class of 15 kids and there's 15 of your other kids sitting at home watching the lesson online, that's a possibility that some districts have done. There are some complications that come with that. But I think there's different ways to sort out the issues, and we just have to be very thoughtful about how we do it.
I understand the leaving options open to districts is done out of a sense of letting them kind of control what's best for their situation. I am wondering if you have any concerns that some districts either won't follow the guidelines, don't have the resources to follow the guidelines, and therefore are putting their staff and students more at risk than others.
Well, what we're saying right now is we have turned out guidance which has specific medical parameters done by experts in the medical field in Boston, which is, you know, Boston is universally regarded, Massachusetts as, you know, a leading medical place in the world. And we're asking people to kind of feasibility test what in-person learning could look like. And so we're going to get more of that information in the next several weeks to see, you know, can districts do this or not? What does it look like? Some districts might be able to do it without making any changes to their schedules. Some districts might need to just stand up a few extra classrooms to reduce class size. And then there are some districts that might have to do something different because maybe the class sizes are large or what have you. And so what we need to do is have schools and districts do this feasibility testing given these new medical parameters, and then we'll really have a better sense of what is possible.
I'm glad you mentioned class size, because I think that's something obviously some districts had expressed concern over, but also something that some were surprised there wasn't some sort of guidance in terms of class sizes. Why did you guys decide not to include that in the plan?
Well, it's just done differently, right? It's not done by specific number. It's done by specific distance. So what we said was we want our districts and schools to aim for 6 feet of distancing, but no less than 3 feet. And so it's that 3-foot number which will determine what class sizes can be, and it'll be based on the size of the classroom. So obviously larger classrooms can hold more students and smaller ones will hold fewer, but that is kind of the individual school and district work that needs to take place so that districts and schools can understand what is feasible or not.
Are you concerned at all about the timeline in doing so? I mean, we're looking, you know, only a few months before September. It's pretty tight to get ready for the school year anyway, and now we have all these additional challenges.
No, I think, you know, the superintendents and principals have really kind of risen to the challenge around this feasibility study. And, I think that they're going to be able to turn that around relatively quickly. And with that said, you know, the summer is approaching. I know it seems like the school year has just ended, but the new school year starts quickly. And so there is work to be done. And, you know, we're going to endeavor to do it.
I'm curious in terms of input, how much you've heard from parents as you've been formulating this plan. The Massing Polling Group survey that I mentioned found that almost 70% of parents say they haven't been asked for input on the reopening. Do you wish that there had been more parental involvement, and is there a way that could have been done, or do you feel that you've adequately heard from that population?
So we at the state have heard a lot from parents on a variety of issues. Perhaps the one that's we've heard most often is about complex special needs parents who want their kids back in school because their kids have been regressing significantly by not having the services they get at the school. With that said, we've put in our guidance kind of a requirement that districts and schools reach out multiple times to families over the summer to get a sense of where they're at, and connect with them, make sure they have updated information from families, and really make sure that they are staying in touch with them, because there was some concern that not every district had been staying robustly in touch with their families throughout the outbreak.
Yeah, Commissioner Riley, as we're winding to a close here, I want to ask you, as we've been having lots of conversations over the last few weeks, something that is kind of been present through all of them is our national reckoning with racial inequity. And I'm wondering if you see this as a moment to potentially make major changes or reforms to either curriculum or what schooling looks like. How are you thinking about that in this moment?
So equity has been one, if not the top priority of the department since I took over a couple years ago. We have a real focus inside of the department on improving the diversity amongst our teachers and principals and superintendents. Right now, we know 40% of our students are students of color, but only 8% of our teachers are. And we need to do better. The research is clear that students who see someone that looks like them are more likely to do better academically in high school and more likely to have better life outcomes. And yet we are behind on really diversifying our workforce. At the same time, we recognize that kids have a lot of questions, right? And there's been heightened anxiety amongst everyone in the country. And we think that schools are the place where, I think in Massachusetts, we have the best teachers in the country. And I think that our kids would benefit by having them at the head of the class leading some of these discussions, some of which may involve, by the way, how are we reflecting all voices in our curriculum?
So that disparity that you outlined is pretty staggering. Do you have any specific steps? I mean, I understand everybody's thinking and talking about how to increase diversity, but do you have specific steps you'd like to see or that you recommend for districts across the state?
So I did some of this work in my previous role in Lawrence, where we were able to triple the number of Latino teachers in a 5-year period. And we were able to do that because we were able to kind of track our high school graduates who went to college, bring them back, offer them things like signing bonuses, tuition reimbursement. We put them in something called the NACA program, which is this amazing mortgage program where no points, no closing costs. And if your average person is getting a mortgage rate for 4% today, we were getting our young teachers a mortgage rate for like 1% or 2%. And so we were able to kind of rebuild our middle class in Lawrence by bringing our students back. And they were getting mortgages that were significantly cheaper than what they would have had to pay in Lawrence for rent. And so I think there are a suite of services and inducements that we can make to try to improve the diversity of our teacher corps.
That's Jeff Riley, Commissioner Riley.
On a large scale. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I appreciate it. I think something to really chew on there. That's Jeff Riley, Commissioner of Early and Secondary Education. Commissioner Riley, thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering, have you been hearing a lot of this lately? Those are the sounds of fireworks popping outside one of our producer Walt's apartment last night, as they have been most nights for the past few weeks. And we weren't sure when we sent him out last night if he'd be successful getting that sound, but you might not actually be surprised he was. That's because from Boston to Salem to New Bedford, authorities are reporting a massive uptick in firework complaints this year. Mayor Walsh actually said complaints in Boston through the month of May were up more than 2,000%. So what is going on? Here to help us break it all down is LaQuisha Burke, president of the West of Washington Coalition, a neighborhood group in Dorchester. LaQuisha, welcome to Radio Boston.
How you doing, Chris? Thanks for having me. I appreciate having an opportunity to come on your show to speak about some community issues.
Yeah, we're happy to check in with you. And also joining me and you is Bill Forey, editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Bill, welcome back to Radio Boston to you as well. All right, we'll check on whether or not we have Bill there, but I also want to hear from all of you out there. Are you hearing fireworks in your neighborhood? Does it feel like it's more than usual? Is it affecting your sleep, or is it stressing you or maybe your dog out? Or are you yourself setting them off, or do you know someone who is? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So before we dive into what's going on in Dorchester, I do want to say that this is a problem happening, as we said, across the country. And so let's check in with a North Shore community in Salem. Mayor Kim Driscoll recently announced a new campaign cracking down on fireworks in Salem. Mayor Driscoll, welcome to Radio Boston to you as well.
Great to be here, Chris.
So, Mayor Driscoll, give us a sense of what the situation is like in Salem in terms of the fireworks.
Sure. We have a number of residents who are just really feeling fed up and frustrated, similar to Boston and so many other communities. I talk to colleagues out in Western Mass on the South Shore. Everyone is just seeing a huge uptick in both the amount of activity and the shell size of the fireworks. You know, so it's louder and it's more disruptive, and folks are pretty sleep deprived and really concerned about the disturbance. Last year, from May 1st to June 15th, we had 5 fireworks complaints logged into our offices. This year, for that same time period, we've had over 114 complaints logged in. So we've seen a 2,180% increase as well. And I think beyond the disruption that it causes for young families, anyone living with trauma, and pets, we're also concerned about the fire safety hazard. We have a lot of wood frame structures. We're a fairly dense city. And so it's something we're trying to take seriously and see if we can stem the activity from happening.
Yeah. Why do you think it's such an increase this year, and how are you planning on tackling this issue in Salem?
Yeah, you know, we're really not exactly sure why, what's made a big difference. We've speculated that, you know, without any other ceremonies happening, people are celebrating graduations and birthdays and anniversaries in this way. We don't know if there's more marketing. We are close to the New Hampshire line, and there seems to be a lot of marketing happening from some of the fireworks companies there directly targeting communities, or if it's just something that everyone took their federal stimulus checks and bought fireworks. We are really not sure. From our perspective, we are trying to make sure people know that this is illegal, what the dangers are. So we've got a robust public education campaign we're working on. We've also adopted sort of an anonymous reporting tool so residents can log on and help us pinpoint where these things are happening. So oftentimes, even when we respond, sort of people scatter. You're not really sure who is lighting off the fireworks. So if we can track it and log it, we can try some more targeted interventions. And then really trying to have both fire department personnel and police helping through our community policing efforts, you know, have people recognize that not only are these unlawful, they're dangerous. And so we have increased fines and are doing everything we can to remind people how disruptive and disrespectful it is to neighbors.
Yeah, that's Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll. Mayor Driscoll, thanks so much for checking in with us today. Appreciate it.
Sure, Chris.
So, LaQuisha, I want to spin this to you, LaQuisha. You just heard what the mayor had to say about Salem. How does that compare to what you're experiencing in Dorchester?
I definitely would ditto her experience. We are experiencing the same things here in Dorchester with fireworks all hours of the night. I mean, they start maybe around 7 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe 6, which it's not even dark yet. However, we will hear them at those hours, and then they will carry on throughout the night and all throughout the middle of the night, 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. You wasn't really sure where they were coming from. You know, so we definitely have been dealing with that. But one of the ways that we've been trying to work with the community, opposed to calling the police all the time, which, you know, unfortunately we had to call the police to have them come out because it was just that bad. But a way to try to not have to call the police, we have been working with the community. We drafted up a nice letter just basically saying, like, hey, this is who we are. We're the West of Washington. We would like everybody to just be respectful to the community. We have, you know, seniors in the neighborhood. We have veterans that suffer from PTSD. We have children that need to go to school in the morning. And we have pets that, you know, are just not that fond of fireworks. And so we just gave a kind letter, just asking people for consideration, not really like telling them, hey, you know what I mean, stop doing this. We're just basically saying, hey, can you have consideration if you are going to do it? Because it is at a point where it's not really controlled that much. You know what I mean? So
has that made a difference? Have you noticed any kind of response to that letter?
We have noticed that there has been a slowdown in the amount of fireworks that we have heard. However, I think that could be a mix of definitely, I want to give it up to, you know, our police department. I have seen them definitely patrolling the neighborhood, looking around. So it definitely makes things more safe. So I think in conjunction with the police doing their ride-throughs, our letters, and definitely complaints to the mayor's office, I think all those things together help to kind of tone things down. With the particular neighbors that, you know, were doing them at the time. But we do feel like it has slowed down just a tad. It's not non-existent.
Right. Yeah, we're starting to get some calls lined up, 1-800-423-8255. I want to get right to phones. But first, Bill Forey, I want to bring you in on this as well. You've been covering Dorchester for a long time. What are you seeing and hearing, and have you ever seen anything like this before?
Hi, Chris. Look, every summer is bad, okay, in terms of the noise level with fireworks. And people who've lived in Dorchester for any amount of time, many of us are pretty used to it. I liken it to airplane noise, which is another issue, quality of life issue in the city. And sometimes you learn to tune it out. This summer, that's pretty much impossible to do in the spring. And this is going back months now. So it's had an effect of there's definitely more complaints. There's definitely more calls to Boston Police for folks seeking to mitigate it. And what we've seen in our coverage is Councilor Julia Mejia, who has really been leading on this issue locally. She lives in Dorchester and represents the whole city. She convened an online forum a couple of weeks ago. It drew a large amount of residents, 370 people registered, and then many other people participated and watched it. And people were from all corners of the community are concerned about it. We heard, especially in a poignant way, from Ronald Odom, whose son was murdered back in 2007 in Dorchester, his son Stephen. And he talked about how when he was a young man, and when he was a kid growing up here, he used to, you know, play with fireworks like a lot of us did. It's not an uncommon thing. Right. But what's happened to him is that this onslaught of fireworks, sometimes all day and all night, it really is a trigger for him, a reminder of his son's death. And I think people in our community have to convey those kind of messages to one another, let our neighbors know. For those of us who are suffering from, whether it be PTSD or who have young children or pets who are disturbed by this, that this is a real thing and that folks need to be aware of the effects it's having on their neighbors.
Yeah, you mentioned Boston City Councilor Julia Mejia, her efforts to address this issue. We actually spoke to her earlier today, so I want to play a little bit of that.
We also filed an ordinance through the City Council to have, you know, to explore an alternate response instead of police. So my hope is through this ordinance that we create alternate ways to deal with these sort of calls.
So she's talking about organizing with community groups, youth programs, and basically trying to bypass law enforcement on this. What do you make of that approach? I'll throw this to either of you guys.
Yeah, I would take it first. I think she filed this along with Michelle Wu and Lydia Edwards, two of her colleagues on the council. I think that there's some merit to this. And, you know, I think Boston Police probably might be among those who would like to see this be somebody else's problem. Boston Police show up to these scenes often, and they're summoned in this context this season so often by fireworks calls. And there's very little they can do. They don't have the power to arrest anybody for firing off fireworks because it's not enforceable that way. You can seize the fireworks and you can fine people, but you're not going to arrest them. And by the way, people in our community really don't want to see people, you know, being arrested for this. I think it's something that that I think Councillor May is onto something, that there could be some kind of alternate city service that responds to these calls and seeks to address it in cooperation with neighbors.
Yeah, LaQuisha, I'm curious.
I'd definitely like to add on to that. I also feel like, in addition, there needs to be like just more resources for the kids. I feel like right now the kids don't have anything else to do, nor do the adults. However, you know, offering them something, making sure that they're busy throughout the summer, maybe community groups putting on, you know, different days where their street kind of gets a break from traffic, where we give out like some, you know, some ice cream cones or maybe some, you know, popsicles or whatever to the kids. Like, we have to find another way for them to like use their energy, whether it's getting them jobs. West Washington has been working with TNT, which is the Talbot Norfolk Triangle, and we have actually been creating a program where we can actually help some of the youth within our community to have summer jobs so they don't have to be outside doing fireworks and not being busy. The reason why the West of Washington advocated to get a park put in our neighborhood is so that the kids have somewhere to play, so that they do not have to be doing things like fireworks. You know what I mean? Just giving them things that are really constructive, and definitely letting them know that the community is here for them and trying to like help them through this difficult time. And not just this time, but, you know, all the times in the future, because there will be times where there will be dead space where, you know, we may have to fill that with just some love and some joy and some happiness for our community. And maybe once people see that, you know, we're here for the community, we're here to try to incorporate everybody in, we want everybody to kind of be a part, then maybe when these type of situations come up, we can all have better conversations in regards to it, not just calling the police.
Because
like you said, nobody wants
point,
to call
LaQuisha.
The police. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We just want everybody to be happy and people have respect for each other.
I think you're right on the money there. Let's get some callers in here. Maureen in Roslindale, you're up first. Maureen, welcome. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Well, initially when I called, I was going to say that these are challenging times and maybe we all just need to take a breath. I want to thank LaQuisha for that very well-phrased letter. I think it just, you know, speaks to what a good representative of her community she must be. We live in Roslindale, West Roxbury, and we're hearing fireworks every single night. And yes, they are starting, you know, from afternoon and sometimes, you know, 2-3 in the morning. You know, our way has just been turn up the air conditioner higher. It feels like it's not that different than a power saw or a lawnmower or a hedge clipper that somebody might be running during the day. However, I did hear Bill's concerns about, I think it was Bill, about people who suffer from PTSD and people who have pets, and this may be challenging.
Or young children that are trying to sleep. I think there are a lot of different factors here, Maureen, and thank you so much for the call. I want to bring in another caller here, Shelley in JP. Shelley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So what's your experience been like? Have you been hearing fireworks?
Yes, we've been hearing fireworks almost every night, and sometimes I till 4 in the morning. And last week, my husband and I took a walk down to the police station in JP just to see what they knew about it. And they are totally aware, and not much they can do unless they actually catch them. Well, I'm telling you what they told me, unless they can catch them in the act. And it's not fireworks that I see colors. It's just, you know, loud banging, whether, you know, years ago as a child, people use caps and all that, but this is loud. Of course, now with the windows closed and the AC on, it's not as bothersome, but I think if whatever the reason they're doing it, if they need more activities to keep people busy, young people busy, that was a great idea from LaQuisha. So
Yeah, that why is an interesting question, and thanks so much for the call, Shelley. We actually spoke to April Walton earlier today. She's the manager of Phantom Fireworks in Seabrook, New Hampshire, so kind of just over the border. And she says that in her 31 years at the store, business is busier than she's ever seen it, but she did draw an interesting comparison back to 2008.
During that recession, people were having staycations, so we saw a big uptick again then, because people were staying home instead of going away and spending thousands of dollars on their travel and, you know, hotels or whatever and eating out. So they were coming here and getting fireworks and having, you know, family barbecues in their backyard.
I thought that was really interesting, and I'm curious, Bill and LaQuisha, what you think if this is if this increases from people just blowing off steam.
Have something to say about Phantom Fireworks, okay? I'm fired up about Phantom Fireworks, okay? Let me just tell you, because they have been sending flyers to our community promoting fireworks and promoting people to buy fireworks, and they feel like just because they write on the flyer, fireworks are illegal in the state of Massachusetts, that it's okay to peddle this within our communities. So not only if people didn't have access to get into fireworks, they're giving them access by sending these flyers to their house. So I personally have made a phone call to Phantom Fireworks. And I spoke to the legal department, and I told them that they should take all of the Boston, Massachusetts zip codes off of their, especially in the city of Boston, should take the zip codes off of their mailing address because fireworks are illegal in the city of Boston. So that's what I feel about Phantom Fireworks.
Yeah, not just the city of Boston. They're illegal in the entire state of Massachusetts. Yeah. And it is interesting because April also told us that New Hampshire customers actually make up their smallest percentage. They have a big chunk of Massachusetts customers, but they also have customers from all around the region, Connecticut, New Jersey. Bill, I'm wondering, what's your take on that in terms of marketing and the access to fireworks kind of across the border?
Right. Well, and of course, that's not a new phenomenon. Every year, obviously, New Hampshire is a prime source of munitions. But to the why, I think what we've heard from Boston police who are responding to neighbors' complaints, and we're privy to those communications. The community service officers here in District 11 in Dorchester, for instance, are legitimately telling neighbors, look, this is a perfect storm, and we've never seen anything quite like it either. They are attributing it to the quarantine, to the effects of people being stuck at home and being stuck at home indefinitely in some measurement. And there's nothing much that the police can do about it. So they're telling people, look, you gotta kind of weather this out. And that's been their communication to residents who are complaining.
And I should note that April also told us that they don't promote illegal use, that they focus on legal sales. I'm just curious if you two have some final thoughts. It's not even July 4th. I think we can probably expect this to continue. Yeah, go ahead.
I do have a final thought. Like, my biggest concern about definitely the fireworks is not just the noise and the inconsideration for the community and the neighbors and the people that really need to get their sleep, but it's also with crime coming with it. You know what I mean? So it's more like the fireworks are being gone off. You don't know if it's a gunshot or if it's a firework. The police have come, you know, to our community several times in regards to either fireworks or a shooting within our community. And for our neighbor not to know if something is a firework or a gunshot and if they're safe or not, that's our biggest concern within our community. We want our community to be safe. You know what I mean? We don't want our houses to burn down. We don't want our neighbors' cars to be shot up with those Roman candlesticks. And we don't want people's roof catching fire. You know what I mean? So I think our biggest concern is safety for our community.
Yeah, that's LaQuisha Burke, president of the West Washington Coalition, a neighborhood group in Dorchester. LaQuisha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also with us was Bill Forey, editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Bill, always great to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just last hour, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced a new equity cabinet within his administration, as well as a major initiative in the city aimed at raising millions of dollars to address racial inequity in Boston.
This fund will invest in nonprofits that empower black and brown residents, in economic development, in public health, in youth employment, in education, in the arts, in other areas. Its mission is to increase safety and well-being and equity in the prosperity of the black and brown community.
It's called the Boston Racial Equity Fund, and the chair of the steering committee is Lee Pelton. He's a president, also the president of Emerson College, and he joins us now. President Pelton, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you.
So I'd love to start if you could just tell us a little bit more about what the fund aims to do and how it will accomplish that goal.
Well, first of all, let me say that I applaud the mayor's efforts and initiatives to both create this cabinet-level program and also to create this equity fund. Would also like to note, of course, that, you know, this is an initiative that he and his leadership team have been working on for some time. I know that John Barros, economic leadership there, has been working on this. This is tangible. It is real. And it can make a real difference in our community. And as the mayor spoke this afternoon, the purpose of this is to close the racial disparity gaps in economic development, in public health, in youth unemployment, in education, and in net worth, much more.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is coming amid a national push to address some of the systemic racism in our country, and we've got protests calling for defunding police departments and demonstrations over police killings. Are you satisfied with the response from Boston so far, and how severe do you think the racial divide is here in the city?
Well, you know, we obviously have a very long way to go with respect to what we refer to as structural racism, which is different than bigotry. That refers to the structural impediments that continue to create and sustain, these disparities along racial lines. The ones that I just mentioned in economic development, public health, and education, and net worth, and so on. This is a step forward in the right direction. It's a positive step, obviously. I do want to emphasize that, you know, this is not something to be fixed. And what I mean by that, this is not something that we fix and then walk away from it. This is going to require a long-term, sustained commitment, because the issues that are being addressed have been around really since the founding of this nation.
Yeah, I want to ask you, President Pelton, on a personal level, after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of white police officers, you wrote an incredibly powerful letter to the Emerson community about your personal experience. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your decision to send that letter and what the process was like writing it.
Well, as I said at the beginning of the letter, I'm writing both as a black man in America and as a president. And my purpose was to make the invisible visible. By telling my own story. I mean, stories are very powerful. They're instruments of change. And in telling my story, it was my hope that I could also tell George Floyd's story, the man that we knew before a police officer put his knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds with his left hand casually in his left pocket. I said in my letter that what made this possible is that George Floyd was invisible to this police officer. He wasn't human, and it was his invisibility and the dehumanization of him that allowed this officer to murder him. very casually and with great callous and in plain sight.
Yeah, I mean, again, the letter itself is powerful, and obviously the stories behind it even more so. I'm wondering, you have a leadership role at Emerson. Did that complicate your decision to write it, and what's the reaction been like since you put that out there?
Well, I've gotten great support. You know, it's apparently reached millions of people, and I've gotten emails from around the world, so it's had an impact. I think one of the things that it has done, at least I'm told that it has done, is to open the door for other Black leaders to tell their stories, very similar to my own, and to make it clear, particularly to white America, that having privilege does not inoculate Black and brown people from racism. It does not, and it does not inoculate them from the great racial disparities that we face. You know, I should also mention that I'm very pleased that the Boston Equity Fund will complement the work that's already underway by some of Boston's most prominent men and women of color in the executive ranks, who have initiated their own equity fund.
Yeah, President Pelton, obviously we're starting to run out of time, and there's so much to talk about. We'd love to have you back sometime down the road to really kind of dig into this stuff. But I do want to close by asking, at the end of your letter, you say the most important question is, what are you going to do? So kind of a two-part, are there specific plans of things you plan to do at Emerson? And what would you say to someone who says, this is such a big problem, what can I, an individual person, actually do to help?
Yeah, well, we're going to do a lot at Emerson, from redoubling our efforts in recruiting students, retaining students, in terms of hiring, making sure that there is diversity at the senior leadership level, that there are folks of color, brown and Black folks of color there. We're also going to look at our procurement operation and make sure that we're acting affirmatively with hiring and contracting with businesses owned by folks of color. So we'll do a lot of that. But most of all, we understand that we have to do this with a kind of incredible urgency, because this is not a moment. This is a movement that we're in. And this is really a reckoning for America that we'll have to deal with.
And then in terms of listeners who are out there saying, how can I help? What is it I should be doing? Do you have a message for them? We've only, unfortunately, got about 30 seconds. But
yeah, well, I would say for those of you who protest and march, thank you. You know, these protests and rallies have been multiracial. They've been very young, some people in high school. And the most important thing is go read your history so that you understand to a full extent the race in America.
Lee Pelton is the 12th president of Emerson College. President Pelton, again, love to have you back on sometime down the road. Really appreciate your time today.
I look forward to it. Thank you for having me.